With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Mark Cuban, publisher of industry magazine Inside Film.
I'm Jackie Keith, the editor of Inside Film.
We're self-appointed experts in content and in making each other laugh.
Welcome to our podcast On The Tools, where we recommend things you should watch, listen to, read, or scroll through.
This week, we're going to be talking about podcast Ballad of Billy Balls,
TV series The Bureau, and book Far From the Tree,
and new Mike Tyson's YouTube channel and podcast Hot Boxing. It's our third episode.
It is. We're back.
We're back.
We haven't been told to stop yet, so we're still continuing.
last week you spoke about a podcast you listened to, Mona Shalabi.
Yeah. Am I Normal?
Am I Normal? And you sort of touched on friends. I think
it's the idea that every person has 150 friends, which. Do you have 150 friends?
Well, maybe. On my Facebook and socials, I do. But I was interested in best friends, and I think you said best friends were like 15. And
yeah.
So I spent a bit of time going through my socials, my phone book, and I'm happy to report I have 16 best friends.
Well, aren't you popular?
I am popular. And I include you in that.
Oh, aren't you special? You're so kind. You're not in mind. No.
Okay, so a podcast I've listened to, I think you've listened to as well, is called yes. Ballad of Billy Balls.
You forced me to listen to the first episode in your car.
I did. Oh, look, I really, really, really enjoyed this podcast. It's written and hosted by Io Tillett Wright. The backdrop for this story starts in New York City in 77, a city which was on the verge of bankruptcy, and the level of social deprivation inspired so many movements and genres and the rise of amazing musicians and artists. You know, artists like Andy Warhol, Rob Mapplethorpe, and Jean-Michel Basquiat. Basquiat was part of the Same-O movement, a kind of graffiti duo, whose street art focused on social dichotomies such as wealth versus poverty, integration versus segregation, and generally the imbalance of class. At that time, the Lower East Side of Manhattan was kind of a cultural hotbed, and where rap, punk, and street art coalesced into, I guess, early hip-hop music culture. And if you lived there at that time in the South Bronx, you would have witnessed the birth of acts like Mexi Ray, DJ Kool Herc. And he was a DJ. He's quite fascinating because I read a bit about him. And he's probably the first person who bought two of the same records on two turntables and started scratching and creating manual loops in dance clubs, and also introduced, I guess, a lot of the street hip-hop artists. Then there was Grandmaster Flash and Africa Bambaataa. And across town, venues like CBGB's and Max's Kansas were home to many emerging acts like, you know, Suicide, The Ramones, Patti Smith, Blondie, Talking Heads, which would have been like fucking amazing to be there at that time, I think. Just the fusion of genres, and there was a lot of really interesting things going on, and a lot of it around social issues. So in this podcast, this is the backdrop setting, which kind of captures the grime, filth, and hope of those that gravitated to the city at that time, looking for whatever they were looking for. And for all intents and purposes, this is a setting for this, I don't know, modern Romeo and Juliet love story which was set in 77. You know, Rebecca meets Billy, model meets musician, and their worlds intertwine. You know, he's a guy who's got street cred, understands the mean streets of New York, how to survive and how to make it in showbiz, and they both have ambitions that they're going to be stars. Then one day she comes home to find that Billy has been shot. The police are turning their place upside down. Billy survives for 10 days until suddenly, despite an optimistic recovery, he dies and is sent to an anonymous burial ground. The writer and producer, I.O. Tillett Wright, somehow manages to convey in this podcast the hope and ambitions of two people who are desperately in love amongst this chaotic backdrop. The podcast is something that appears to be one thing at first and then morphs into something else. And if you're wondering what happened to those people who came to New York in around 77, Rebecca is a great subject. Excellent production. killer theme song.
The theme song is the best part. It really sets the scene and gets you like really excited.
I think, you know, I.O. Tillett Wright did an amazing job in terms of, you know, normally podcasts are kind of set in a controlled environment and, you know, and what she does, she kind of is on the move. And so they go and explore New York and interview people, and she takes you there. And, you know, it's a story, love story, where Rebecca doesn't ever really recover from Billy's death and just kind of exists. So 37 years later, I.O. Tillett Wright finally comes to create this podcast and really wants to discover what happened and desperately attempts to give Rebecca some peace. But it's also a journey for I.O. Tillett Wright. The podcast is The Ballad of Billy Balls. Did you listen to all of it?
Yeah, I listened to the whole thing.
Did you love it?
Yeah, of course. I think it's really, it seems like it's going to be a true crime podcast, and it sort of ends up being something quite different. But yeah, like it's really good at setting the scene. So you feel like you're there with them because like they use the sound design really cleverly. Like it feels like you're in the street with them. And like when they go to Billy's grave, you're on the ferry with them and stuff like that.
It's quite bleak, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit bleak. Oh, not entirely. Rebecca is also just has like the most incredible voice. So you just want to listen to her talk constantly. But do you want to?
Kind of reminds me of Nancy Spungett, you know, the girlfriend of Johnny. Was it Johnny Rotten or Lydon, whatever his name was from the Sex Pistols? And she's a woman who obviously has seen a lot of stuff.
yes,
and really hasn't emerged from, I guess, that person she was in 1977.
It's almost like her, when Billy Balls died, she just stopped progressing in life. Yeah,
yeah.
Despite having a child and all these things. So, but yeah. Do you want to give away that Rebecca is?
No, I don't think so. I think we'll just leave some stuff, you know, in the box. But look, really great podcast. I think a great story. And yeah, the production for me really got me. Like, you know, I put the headphones on and it took me on a great ride. And I loved it a lot.
Mm.
Now, what are you watching?
Oh, so all my French speakers out there, I'm going to butcher some French as I talk about this show, but so I apologize in advance. But I've watched all 5 seasons of French series, The Bureau, which is on SBS, and I highly recommend it. So it's created by Eric Rochon, and that's probably not how you pronounce it, but bear with me. It's set within the DGSE, which is the French equivalent of the CIA. Specifically, it's within the Bureau of Legends, where basically they train and handle deep cover agents or spies on long-term missions overseas. So it's based on real accounts of former French spies. And I guess the main character is a man named Guillaume, codenamed Malatru, who returns to France after six years undercover in Syria. And he comes back, he can't really connect with his former life, including his daughter, who when he left was, you know, a little kid, and now she's 18. And a huge part of this is because when he was in Syria, he had an affair with this married woman named Nadia El Mansour, and not related to his mission at all. He just sort of fell in love with her while he was there. But because of this, he kind of finds himself sort of unable to give up his alias and compelled to contact her. Like, he's meant to destroy all forms of identification that have this alias on, like Paul Lefebvre was his name. He can't, he hides it and he keeps an email that was connected to him and stuff like that.
Oh, he's a protocol breaker.
Basically. And then Nadia shows up in Paris and he begins to see her again, and life sort of unravels from there, and including for the DGSE, because yes, protocols are there for a reason, apparently.
They are.
But that, like, that's the main story, but you also sort of follow other characters within the bureau as they go about their mission. So there's especially like a young woman named Marina, who's probably in her late 20s or early 30s, who's training to go undercover in Iran. And she's really green, and she's sort of our entryway into the world and what it means to be a spy. And you sort of get a sense of what that means for you personally, because like in one of the early episodes, her handler, Marie-Jean, talks to her like, the friends that you make undercover, they're still your enemies because they make you drop your guard and they make you vulnerable and fallible. And you sort of see this happen for her for all like across the seasons, grappling with this. You meet people while you're on missions that you like, but you might be trying to get information from them, or they might just be someone who your alias is friends with. And then anyway, so she says to her, like, people you really like must be destroyed. But I don't know, it's just a really cleverly crafted, tense political thriller that goes across France to Iran, Russia, Syria. And it's really inspired by or informed by contemporary political events.
How many seasons so far?
There's 5 seasons. But wow. I think it ends at the end of the 5th season, like, so it's over, it's finished. I think it ended last year. But I think why it's really successful is it kind of avoids the kind of the tropes of the spy genre. It's really nuanced. Like, it feels like a realistic account of what it's like to be a spy and like how they're trained and the tradecraft they use. And like, I've pictured to heaps of people, like, this is a more realistic version of Homeland, which at times, like, I liked Homeland, but sometimes it bordered on this sort of ridiculous. And like, it's just really refreshing that this is French and not American. Like, I think we always watch spy things that are set in the CIA. And like, but like,
a nice slant. I guess the big question is, could you be a spy?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because when I watched this show, I became like kind of obsessed by the idea, like, could I be a spy? And like, even so, if you go on, I think, and like, by even saying this out loud, I'm knocking myself out of the running, but if you go on like the ASIO website, there's like a animation, or it's not animation, it's like a video training thing you can do, and it's sort of like a test, and the Australian government really uses this to see whether you would have skills to be
a good spy. You go to the ASIO site and there's a test.
Yeah, it's like you're meant to, like, you walk through an airport and there's all these different things happening, and you're trying to, you're meant to notice things that happen around you and patterns and like some, you peep things out of the ordinary. And and then they go to another part where you're sitting in a crowded restaurant and there's 5 different conversations happening, and you're like with someone, but you're trying to listen to a conversation that's happening on the other table at the same time. So, and then you get a little score. And then if you want to apply to become, I think it's ASIO, I forget the name of the one that is like, ASIO is within Australia, but there's ASIS or something like this, is the overseas one. And yeah, you can use that code if you want to apply.
To give it a go.
So I did this, but I cheated it and did it again the second time to get a better score. But I'm not going to apply to be a spy because I think I am actually a terrible liar. And nor
do you have to lie? I guess you're making up everything, aren't you?
Well, I think that it's sort of talked about this in the show. It's almost like you're not lying because you're believing the lie yourself. So that's how you... And you weave into your alias parts of who you are. So it's almost like it's not a lie because the person is you, but it's also not you.
It's like me and my music, thinking I'm a musician, but unfortunately I'm not.
A rapper. Maybe you should play some of the.
No, I will not. That is that was a lockdown hobby.
But like it's you can sort of see also, like his daughter, Guillaume's daughter, is sort of becomes part of the show, and you can see how it affects her, not being able to know what is really going on with her dad, and just how isolating, confusing it is for her. So yeah,
I watch. Remember, we watched The Americans.
Yeah, is The Americans.
Is it similar to that?
I would say it feels more realistic again. Like The Americans, some of the stuff that happens in there, I'm like, that feels like it wouldn't have been real. But yeah, it's a similar kind of vibe for sure. The Americans is also a great show.
A great show, but it was just a house of lies.
Yes. And like their whole relationship was a lie and everything is a lie. But then it becomes a real relationship. So
I wonder what happens if that is like if that's your chosen career and you have this career path. I mean, what happens in retirement? Like, do you just see ya, sign off, and then, or do you just disappear?
Well, that is also a plot line in the show where one of them is sort of heading towards retirement, and then he's trying to grapple with that. So yeah, I don't. It would be so strange. And then you can't ever talk to anyone about anything you did in your career, and you probably have a fake, like probably you tell people you were a diplomat or whatever you were. But like, I don't know what you would tell. You can't be honest with your children. You can't be honest with your partner. You can't be honest with anyone in your life.
I have a friend who I think is
a spy.
Yeah. I can't, of course I will not reveal the name. I think I told you about this, but,
you may be murdered.
She works in media, but has, you know, I mean, was in the Middle East, was in a whole bunch of places. And I'm thinking, why are you there? I don't understand. And she sort of disappears for long periods of time. And
is she fluent in multiple languages?
And then returns. No, she's such a yobbo.
That's a good cover.
It's bizarre. Anyway, so I'll just throw it out there. If I'm gone, you know why. If I go
missing. I feel like you maybe need to scrub this part out. All you need is headphones.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What have you been watching?
That was what I was watching. I could tell you what I've been reading.
What you're reading? What are you reading?
Well, to be honest, I read this book actually a really long time ago, but like a while ago, my same friend who is in charge of the WhatsApp book club group also asked me over drinks at the pub to like name the book that has impacted me the most profoundly or something like that. And this book was the first thing that came to mind. So the book is called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity by Andrew Solomon. And I actually read this book because I saw Andrew Solomon give the opening night address at the Sydney Writers Festival back in, I think, 2014. So it's been a while since I read this book, but it stayed with me ever since. And like, without overstating it, it really sort of impacts how I think about certain things. I mean, obviously, particularly parenting, given that that's the topic of the book. But and that's despite me not having children of my own. So I can maybe sound like an uninformed git talking here. But I mean,
but did that change your views of your parents?
Well, that's it. I think so. And I made my dad read this book actually, and he loved it too, and he made my auntie read it as well. I think so. I think you sort of see I think that, and I think that's part of getting older as well, that you start to realize that your parents are just human beings and make mistakes when they raise
you. It's very hard to see them as human beings.
Well, that's it. But then as you get older, like my
especially father, your dad, the duckweed killer.
My parents just bought a farm, and Mark thinks that my dad doesn't know how to clean the dam properly.
He's killing the duckweed.
But essentially, this book, Solomon documents the experience of 300 parents whose children sort of differentiate from them somehow. So it includes like children who are geniuses, who are transgender, deaf, have Down syndrome, have dwarfism, autism, are criminals. So they have kids that grow up to be criminals of some sort, kids that have schizophrenia, and also children that are born of rape. But there's like a background into why he started writing this book. So Solomon is gay, and he had like I think he's born in 1963, and so he had like a pretty rough time grappling with this as a child. Like particularly his parents kind of struggled to understand and accept him, and this is like despite the fact that they were Jewish and, you know, obviously experienced some prejudice in that way. And like he also had dyslexia as a child, but his mum really advocated for him in that way. But when it came to him being gay, she didn't support him in the same way. Like he said, I wish she had advocated for me as a gay man as much as she'd advocated for my dyslexia, for instance.
There's always that argument too, isn't there? That question, nature or nurture.
Well, yeah, exactly. And then when he's 19, he puts himself into surrogate therapy. So where he is like encouraged by quote unquote doctors to like have sexual encounters with women to try to cure him. And he talks about like, like this whoop, like he had to crawl around naked on all fours while this woman is watching him. And then like he talks about like lying, staring at the ceiling, feeling dead while this like woman is jumping up on top of him going like, you're inside of me, you're inside. But like he goes on to actually have relationships with women in his real life, which he talks about that he loved them and felt like had felt intimate feelings towards them. But he just was all the time denying that he was gay. And so like it's not till years later that he really sort of accepts his identity as a gay man, and then he finds the gay rights movement, particularly his tribe, and he finds other people in New York that are like him, and he comes to terms with who he is. But going on to why he started writing this book, he in like the 90s, early 90s, 93, he's put on assignment as a journalist for the New York Times to cover deaf culture. And he starts to realize like most deaf children are born to hearing parents, and their parents kind of prioritize their children functioning in the speaking world, like kind of fitting into their lives. And then like a lot of deaf people then go on to stumble onto the deaf community in adolescence. And then they sort of like him, they find their own tribe. They're united by this shared difference, and also in the deaf community, it's often with language, so that is like sign language. And so with these other deaf people, their difference isn't an aberration, it's just part of who they are, it's their identity. So he gets interested in this idea that we have vertical identities that we inherit from our parents, so either biologically or culturally. So we have like race, religion, normally language, like we usually speak the same language as our parents, not always, but most of the time, nationality. And then we also have horizontal identities. So these are traits that maybe our parents don't have at all. So they could be, and they're not like, they're either innate, like sexuality, or if you're a genius and sometimes disability, or maybe they're more acquired, like criminality. You sort of learn to be a criminal through your life. So I guess that's like the nature versus nurture thing. But he said like families tend to reinforce vertical identities. So like his family might have reinforced the idea that they're Jewish, but they oppose kind of horizontal ones.
Which is strange because, I mean, obviously you wouldn't know unless family members came out, you know, and a lot of them didn't come out. I mean, they hid that stuff.
I think every family had, you know, a couple of spinsters and bachelors.
Yeah, just you like old I mean? Auntie Blah that
never, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's been living with Auntie Blah for 20
just
years.
Just her very good friend.
Just very good friends.
Yeah. So they talk about like the vertical identities are respected, but your horizontal ones are kind of sometimes treated as flaws, whether they're by your family or by society. So
it sounds like the horizontal aspects are equally as important, if not more.
Well, exactly. They're just like another part of your identity. But so then through this book, he talks to parents who have like this difference somehow from their children. And it deals with like identity and what is normal, identity politics, and I guess like the love between parents and their children. But I think what is really striking and what makes this book really moving is it becomes really clear that it's often that difference is what unites us as humans. And like in that sense, it becomes sort of about what it is to be human. It's like, it says something like, I wrote it down, but like difference unites us while each of these experiences can isolate those who are affected. Together they compose an aggregate of millions whose struggles connect them profoundly. The exceptional is ubiquitous, but to be entirely typical is the rare and lonely state. But there's really high profile subjects in this book as well. Like probably one of the most powerful parts of the book, like he interviews the parents of the children who committed the Columbine massacre. Like it's not an easy book to read. Like it's a really,
it sounds fascinating.
It's a really long book. I think it took me 6 months to read this. Cause like particularly the section about children born of rape, every paragraph is emotionally excruciating and like really difficult. It's just like imagine the experience of profoundly loving your child despite the fact that they are growing up to resemble the man that raped you, either in physically or in some cases in personality as well. So I had to stop every so often, like read something really frivolous and fluffy, but it's really deftly written and it's profoundly moving. And like it took Solomon 10 years to write this book. And so he started writing it initially to sort of understand his own parents and sort of like to explore that pain and regret he felt for his early life when he didn't accept his sexuality and sort of why he didn't. But by the end, he's become a parent himself. So it sort of becomes this full circle moment. And it's interesting, like he talks about his own parents. He's like, he realizes through his life, like, he says it in the book. He said, you can love someone but not accept him. You can accept someone but not love him. Mm. I wrongly felt the flaws in my parents' acceptance as deficits in their love. Now I think about their primary experience was having a child who spoke a language they'd never thought of studying. And he sort of explains that again about this is sort of the experience of lots of parents in the book. Like he says, Rumi said that the light enters you at the bandage place. And this book's conundrum is that most of the families described here have ended up grateful for experiences they would have done anything to avoid. That's particularly, I think, true of some of the parents that have children with disability.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, like there's a documentary made on this book as well, but I haven't seen that. I actually only learned that when I was like sort of researching some stuff to talk about here. And I quickly looked up some of the reviews and they were a bit middling, which is a bit disappointing. But this book is really, really fantastic.
I think it's really, really interesting. I have to say, for me, when I moved to Sydney, finished uni, moved to Sydney and didn't have any friends and I got this cadet.
Now you've got 15 of them.
Now I've got 15 best friends, but I'd never forget there was art director, Eddie Parada, and he could see that on the Friday evening. I didn't know anyone and he said, why don't you come out with us? And so I did, and basically all my friends were gay. And so I had this amazing time with Eddie and his friends and, kind of found a new tribe. And, it's great.
I think that's very true for me as well. I think when I first moved to Sydney, some of the first people that were my friends were gay men, and I think I spent every single weekend at Stonewall for about 10 years.
You're still at Stone.
Yeah, the last 2 years with COVID, but I'll be back soon.
What's the name of that book again?
It's called Fire from the Tree by Andrew Solomon.
I definitely will read that. So I've stumbled across a podcast, and there's a YouTube channel by the same name called Hot Boxin'.
Is it about weed?
Well, look, you know what? I didn't even know that term existed. And when I spoke to people about it, they're like, what, people in a car smoking a bong? And I was like, what?
With the windows up.
I can tell you it's not about that. Look, it was an amazing thing. So a friend of mine who's a boxer suggested this site, and so well, this podcast, YouTube channel, and it is sensational. I won't lie, I enjoy a bit of MMA and boxing, but was never really into wrestling, even at school. I just felt it was too weird. It was like playing Twister with sweaty, stinky boys.
Oh, you're wrestling the girls?
No, there were no girls. It was just, you know, sort of adolescent stinky boys, you know, like, you know, I don't want them popping their zits on my back as they're squeezing me or whatever. It's gross. So the podcast is, regardless of what you think about Mike Tyson, he hosts it. The podcast's amazing. It's perhaps more like an intimate therapy session, and the overarching theme is about struggle, redemption, you know, drive and motivation. I think if I was a writer, screenwriter, or, you know, looking for inspiration and a story idea, this site would be high on my list. It's really, really impressive. He's got, you know, people like Snoop Dogg, the comedian Bill Burr, Eminem, Piers Morgan, Robert Kennedy Jr., Sugar Ray Leonard, Dennis Rodman, Roseanne Barr, Mickey Rourke, goes on. And he's a really good interviewer, and he's really raw. And so it's not about boxing. He does have some boxers on there. He does have some MMA fighters. But I think the podcast and the channel is really about people's struggle and how they get from where they were to where they are. And even when they get to that point of success, a pinnacle of success, you know, then – you know, they retire from boxing, or, you know, they're not writing hit songs anymore, and they become something else and they have a different persona. And also, I guess, you know, that transition from, you know, making a lot of money and being really famous and popular to, you know, not being so famous and not being so popular, not having so much money, or maybe making some bad decisions.
It's like reckoning with becoming, like, aging in a way.
It is. It's very much that. And so anyway, I would urge anyone who wants to go to this site to find the episode with Sugar Ray Leonard firstly. I found this particular ep really difficult to listen to at times, because just that struggle can be brutal and difficult to comprehend. I was really fascinated by Tyson's tales, and, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard was a hero of his, and he revealed that, you know, he was in juvenile detention at age 13, and, you know, he watched Sugar Ray Leonard win the world welterweight championship in 79, and how Tyson, who starts crying, kind of reveals all this stuff of, you know, he was so lost and what had happened to him. And how watching Sugar Ray Leonard really changed his life and gave him this ambition that he wanted to box. And anyway, then Sugar Ray Leonard's looking at him and kind of sideways glance, and you don't know what he's thinking. You know, is this guy mad? And then he reveals that he was a survivor of child sex abuse and, you know, addictions to cocaine and alcohol. And Tyson then talks about, you know, the contrast between being a feared athlete, which he misses, and the man he is today in retirement, and that he does feel empty. What did he say? He said, I was an annihilator. It was what I was born for. Now those days are gone and it's just empty. Just incredible to watch. And, you know, there was a series where they basically hitched up a caravan and drove around with this mobile podcast studio.
Oh, my God.
It was really weird because, you know, normally he's there, he's smoking, you know, I don't know what he's smoking, and it's a studio, proper studio, and suddenly they're in this kind of weird caravan, and that's when Eminem joins them and he does an interview. Really fascinating, amazing stories, and the surprising thing is that everyone who comes on is completely raw. And it's like they leave. They're obviously, they're fighters and they're masculine and, you know, some of them are quite aggressive people. But they kind of seem to leave that at the door. I really recommend having a look at that site. So that was Hot Boxing with Mike Tyson. I think that's it.
Yes, it is it.
Well, I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.